This is Think Inclusive. I'm Tim Villegas. Radical acceptance. What does that mean to you? There is a concept I learned about in college in the early days of studying humanistic psychology in the work of Carl Rogers, unconditional positive regard. According to Rogers, unconditional positive regard involves showing complete support and acceptance of a person, no matter what that person says or does. Now, if this sounds interesting to you, I think you're going to love the conversation I had with Dr. Leah M. Kelly. More after a short break.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to Think Inclusive, where each week we bring you conversations about inclusive education and what inclusion looks like in the real world. Dr. Leah M. Kelly is a storyteller, writer, activist, teacher, educator, education consultant, and parent who identifies as neurodivergent and otherwise disabled. She was a K-12 public school teacher for over 25 years and has extensive experience supporting inclusion. Her newly published book, The Person Who Arrives, Connecting Disability Studies to Educational Practice for Teachers, Parents, and Others, evolved from her doctoral research, which she completed at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia. She is currently working as an adjunct professor in the Faculty of Education, Teacher Education Program at UBC, University of British Columbia, and guest lecturing colleges and other programs and organizations such as CASE, the Canadian Association for Supported Employment. Dr. Kelly's work focuses on connecting disability studies and education to educational practice, strengths-based perspectives for supporting neurodiversity, addressing ableism, inclusive practices and pedagogy, and cultivating advocacy. In this episode of Think Inclusive, Leah and I discuss the power of storytelling and the importance of including diverse perspectives in disability studies and education. Leah shares personal stories and insights, emphasizing the need for radical acceptance and the impact of relationships in fostering inclusion. She also explores the concept of arriving and the connection between acceptance and understanding. Before we dive into our conversation with Dr. Kelly, I want to share a word from this week's sponsor. With 1 in 36 children diagnosed with autism, the Autism Society of America is dedicated to creating connections, empowering everyone in the autism community with the resources needed to live fully. As the nation's oldest leading grassroots autism organization, the Autism Society and its approximately 70 affiliates serve over 500,000 people each year. By championing initiatives that advance equitable opportunities in healthcare, education, employment, safety, and public policy, the organization executes a national reach with meaningful local impact. Through education, advocacy, support, and community programming, the Autism Society works toward a world in which everyone is connected to the support they need when they need it. For more information, go to autismsociety.org. The connection is you. And now, my conversation with Dr. Leah M. Kelly. Leah Kelly, welcome to the Think Inclusive podcast.
Thanks, Tim. I'm super excited to be here.
Leah, we've known each other for a while, but I don't think we've ever had a real long conversation, right?
No, I think we've known each other since like 2012.
Yep, back when we were like bloggers. Remember that?
Mm-hmm. I still sort of am, but like writing a dissertation since 2015, kind of, and then writing a book, my blog is like not very active. My writing's been going elsewhere. But yeah, and then we finally met.
Last year, almost a year ago, actually, yeah. at the TASH conference.
In Phoenix.
In Phoenix, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. It's like one of these, it's a strange thing because, you know, we have both been working towards promoting inclusion and inclusive practices for so long. And it's like, you know, these people by, you know, name and by their writing or by, you know, their podcasting. And all of a sudden it's like, I feel like I know you.
Yeah, it is. And you're like Facebook friends for like over 10 years and, you know, you watch each other's families and, you know, like you see bits of each other's lives and then to actually meet, was pretty cool. And, right. And then to be having this opportunity to work with you in a more professional capacity is great too.
Well, Leah, the thing that, the kind of the impetus of having you on is that you wrote a book. Now I'm very grateful for your advocacy and all of your writing, you know, before that, but our conversation at TASH was, you had a book. And so the book is called The Person Who Arrives, Connecting Disability Studies and Educational Practice for Teachers, Parents, and Others. And it came out this year.
It did in June.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And so I'd love for us to talk about it. And so one of the things, now I got to get my questions up. Sorry.
No, it's good.
One of the thing that it's really forefront in the book is just about storytelling. And there are a lot of stories in the book. And I find that your writing style is actually probably much like your blogging style. And so I'm wondering, like, why is storytelling in particular important to you? And something, a distinction that you make in the book is whose story, like whose story is important and why are we identifying the who in the story? So if we could start off with that, that'd be great.
Of why is storytelling important to me?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I think stories are openings and you mentioned, my storytelling is very much like my blogging style. And at first, actually, when I started the process of all this, my doctoral dissertation that really evolved into this book. I was a little bit worried that I'd been ruined, quote, by blogging and that it would not be a really academic style. And then I just really came to own that that's the way I write. And there's something about blogging where I want to write very accessibly and have short, not just this giant wall of text, but short bits of text that invite the reader to carry on and keep reading. And I like that. I read better that way. And I do think it's very inviting. So I very deliberately decided that, yeah, that accessibility was important to me. And also, stories, I think I already said their openings, their ways in. The stories in my book are really woven in. There's not a point where I introduce, and now I'm going to tell you a story about this. And I told you this story and here's what it meant. I wanted to let the stories do the work and trust in the stories that are included. So I think storytelling is a way to have people consider ideas, and a way to handle sometimes very complex ideas in an invitational way that encourages people to maybe think differently, to engage with different perspectives. When you ask, and research shows, I mean, if we want to say that storytelling is a super powerful way to learn. If we look at how important stories are to little children, their ways of learning, or if you look at folklore, how cultures and communities share history or share what's important or share the way they do things, their pride, stories do that. And so we know stories are useful, a great learning tool, a great way to engage, a great way to build community. And so if I want to say, hey, world, how about we think about this differently? Stories are a tool or a vehicle to bring in other perspectives and invite people to consider things a different way. And then we talk about whose story is anyway.
Tell us more about that idea.
Well, I have this little image I did. I had an assignment where I had to do a drawing or a representation of where I was in my journey. And so I drew myself with frizzy hair in a little wolf suit on a boat that I sketched very much like Sendak's boat in Where the Wild Things Are. Mm-hmm. And then I wrote on the bottom, like, whose story is this anyways? Like, is it? And had me thinking about, like, how often stories are appropriate. Even taken on and interpreted by someone, and the point might be missed, you know, like saying, and I included this story because, right? But it's someone else's story. And also thinking about my right to tell somebody else's story, because I think we have the right to tell our own story. But then I had an opportunity to include other stories with people's permission, of course.
Right. Yeah.
And so so other perspectives like, are pulled in this book. So that idea of who's writing the story, is it written by a disabled person, which is how I identify, as neurodivergent and otherwise disabled. And so I'm telling my story, but also really considering like whose story are we telling? Whose perspective are we drawing upon when we inform our practice as parents and as educators and as people in community? When we consider our conceptualization or understanding of disability, of what it means to be disabled. And big questions about is to be disabled to be broken or less than? And I want to, I hope to challenge those ideas. And yeah, is there that I address that?
Yeah. Cool. Well, yeah. What story, I mean, is there a big story that you're trying to tell with the book? I know you have lots of little stories, you know, whether that's either your story or stories that you've gotten permission to share. But is there a central theme or a bigger story?
I think there would be multiple bigger stories. At the heart, I think, of all of the stories is relationship and how important the way we interact with one another is. And that stories create a way to understand really complex topics or ideas. And then I think the big idea of this book is here's this concept, this whole field, which is disability studies or specifically disability studies in education, And it's not something necessarily that people are familiar with. I didn't encounter it until I was in a doctoral program. And I was like, what? Like, how can this even be? And so to take those ideas that maybe not widely known and for ways to what I hope make these ideas not way in academia or way in certain, you know, circles, but just something that everybody can relate to and access. The idea is that there's other models of disability, like a variety of models of disability, and to consider when we're working with other people, looking at stigma, looking at the importance of language we use, just even how we conceptualize or even the ability to talk about disability, which I think sometimes is really at risk, to being disappeared under, the umbrella of diversity. Oh, well, we are already talking about diversity, so we don't need to specifically name disability. Mm-hmm. And then the stigma around and the reluctance around using the word disability, can be problematic. Especially if we're at risk of erasing that experience and identity and the ability to talk about ableism and address it and stigma. So, and there are some pretty elaborate linguistic workarounds to avoid saying the word.
Yeah, there are.
and with your permission, I will say, you know, like diverse ability and differently abled and handicapable and handicapable is like, oh my. And so what does that say about stigma if we can't even say the word? So even being able to say, yeah, I identify as disabled is a pushback in my perspective and in many people's perspective against the stigma of disability because it's normal. Disability is normal. It's natural. It's part of the full range of human experience.
Right. I always find the workaround language, it may come from a, I don't know. I don't want to assume. It's more like, a person may have, a particular intention of not trying to offend, right?
Mm-hmm.
By using that language, but it shows that, they're probably, if you're using that language, you're probably not in many relationships, with disabled people because the vast majority of people that I've had conversations with that say that they're disabled and use that word are perfectly comfortable using that word.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also not like I haven't met a disabled person that prefers to use other language. So.
Yes.
It's more like an indication of like, well, maybe you should consider having more relationships with people who are disabled before you start using language. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, it totally does. And I think predominantly like teacher education programs and stuff are very heavily informed by people who say you shouldn't say disabled.
Yeah.
Right. There's a tendency. And I also think what you're kind of talking about too could be internalized ableism. Mm-hmm. That people see the word disabled as something full of shame. And I think you're right. With good intent, they've been trained up to not say disabled, but also they think that to say disabled is to be ignoring the things that are wonderful. And so they have to say, you know, differently abled. And so they're still acknowledging ability. Well, of course, there's still abilities, but disability is actually a real thing.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. Yeah. I don't have the answers. I think it can be nuanced. It shifts and changes depending on what groups you're talking with too. Right. And
yeah.
And I think the key thing is to ask people what they prefer and then respect that. But predominantly in the big picture, I want to say disability because I want to change big picture.
Exactly. Things, yeah. You know? Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So you've said in your book that you envision it as an enactment of inclusion. And I'd love for you to unpack that phrase for us.
Okay. Yeah. Well, even just one of the tenets of disability studies is to draw upon lived experience. So even drawing in other stories from other activists, and that is itself, I think, an enactment of inclusion. And then including my own voice and way of being, I really disrupted in many ways what would typically be expected in a book or dissertation. Like, I don't have chapters, I have arrivals, I don't have a table of contents, I have an itinerary, and it's woven together maybe in unexpected ways. And it can jump from a story to a poem to a drawing to more, you know, I'm pulling from research kind of piece. And that is actually really reflective of the way my mind works. It can be kind of a messy swirl of things that just sort of light up and connect like a constellation of stars, but in maybe unexpected ways. I didn't want to tame that. I wanted it to be reflective of that neurodivergent approach that was mixed methodology that drew from different things in unexpected ways and kind of messed things up a little bit, but still took you on this trip. This still was invitational, still was a journey, still was cohesive, like so mixed up, but made sense. It was like putting a puzzle together, actually putting all the stories together. I conceptualize the stories as like little beads on a string. And I actually had this whole file called story beads, right? So I could string them where I wanted and figure out where they belonged, or like floats cast on a net on the sea, you know, that there's these little beads that could be moved about. So not only is my structure different and reflective of like my own neurodivergence, but also in terms of inclusion, and I feel like I need to recognize my privilege, my like white Canadian cis using secure food secure privilege, and having access to academia. And I felt like if I could get my foot in the door, I wasn't going up. And so how do I bring these other perspectives with me? And there is so much beautiful and insightful and rich information available in disabled communities, autistic communities, that isn't drawn upon when we're informing research or informing practice, whether it's our practice as a parent or as an educator or someone working in community. And I saw this gap in terms of both connecting the ideas of disability studies to what we do in our lives, but also this gap that in access, and that these people with amazing work didn't necessarily have access to academia, and that academia wasn't necessarily drawing on this amazing work. And so, very, very deliberately, I took on this notion that blogs, podcasts, and other sources of information are actually peer reviewed. It's just a different set of peers. And maybe a more important set of peers, because it's the people with lived experience in community. And then my idea was like, well, by putting things like blogs or Facebook statuses or things not normally drawn upon not typically drawn upon in academia, in research, by putting them side by side with more traditional sources, I am in essence saying they are of equal value.
Yeah.
So teaching and research and writing is political, and it is an opportunity for activism. And I believe that using the opportunities I've lucked into because of privilege, to shine a light on these other notions, these other ideas, this other really, really important and rich work. It's at the heart of what I wanted to do. I don't do this work alone. I've been absolutely generously granted missions by people in disability communities to include their work and weave it in with my stories and my stories about my relationship with my son. So in that way, this book includes me in my own unusual ways of thinking and being, but it also includes people not normally, typically, often, traditionally included in what might be kind of an academic-ish work, but it's also not an academic work because if we're talking inclusion, it's incredibly accessible. And that's because of stories and doodles and poems and the way it's woven together. So all of those elements, I think, are reflective of what is inclusion and who we bring in and who is welcomed and who is like, let me look at what you have to say or let me include what you have to say because it's so important.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Is there a story that sticks out to you? I know that you might want to read something or share something from the book. Is there something on top of mind?
Well, I have stories with my son and we've sat together and gone over every story. And at every point I was like, you know, we can exclude anything. And he's like, always like really affirming. No, keep it in. So there's a story, called Turn Their Head a Little Bit, of an interaction with Harrison and I, who's my adult son. And should I read that then?
Yeah, that'd be great.
After Harrison completed grade 12 in June of 2018, he was accepted into a one-year workplace employment program at the University of the Fraser Valley for students with disability. In July 2018, prior to the start of the fall term, it seemed timely to discuss how some of the other students might not have the same background in understanding disability as identity and disability pride as he does. Harrison had been enrolled in a distance education school for the past 9 years and had seldom encountered people who were not immersed in disability culture and pride, having been, quite deliberately, surrounded by activists, mentors, and friends in disability communities. I wanted him to consider that the other students may have only ever been told that individuals such as himself were special and never heard of ableism, I suggested. So people might have been hearing their whole lives from their parents and from their schooling that disability is a word you shouldn't use and that they have special needs and that they're special. Harrison added, yeah. Well, they're probably not hearing that from people with disabilities. So there was a comfortable but lengthy pause. And then he went on to explain his notion of gently offering another perspective. So I was thinking about the task program. Try to turn their heads a little bit. Like, it's kind of like Xbox or PlayStation. One has more benefits or slightly better benefits. Some people might like one more than the other, like that sort of thing. But with disability, I checked my understanding. So to kind of just clunk them on the head with ideas about ableism and other things might be harsh, but your notion of turning their head a little bit, showing them there's another way. Yes, he confirmed, like considering Xbox or PlayStation. Oh, I tried to keep pace. It's a metaphor. And in doing that, you're not suggesting what you've been doing is bad, even though you and I might think there are negative things about that. Yeah. Just think about a different view, he cut me off, or perhaps graciously supported my ongoing struggle to process all things gaming, and just turn their head a little bit. That's beautiful.
Oh, I love that.
Quite completely blown away. Harrison confirmed, yeah. And we were both quiet for a long time after that. There was nothing more to say.
I love that perspective. I'm not sure how to address this. I love the perspective of Harrison talking about just trying to change mindsets just a little bit, not hitting anybody over the head with anything. I've definitely experienced both.
Sometimes when you're passionate, it's so hard not to want to do the clonk them on the head, right?
Right.
I feel that frustration at times. And I really appreciate that notion. Sometimes I just take a breath and remind myself of Harrison's words, just turn their head a little bit. Like,
yeah. Yeah. It's beautiful. Well, thank you for sharing that. And thank you to Harrison for, sharing that story as well in the book. So something in the book, well, if you don't mind, I'd like to take some of these questions out of order. Because in the book you talk about, radical acceptance and then this idea of arriving. And I love your table of contents isn't a table of contents and it's an itinerary. I thought that was very, it's clever. Yes, it is clever, but it's also, thoughtful. And I think that when you look at the book, it really is very thoughtfully put together. And so when you use the word arrive, how is this idea of acceptance and arrival connected, or are they? Did I misread that?
First off, thank you. I think you're right. They are connected. Let's start with the idea of arrival. Like I have, like you said, an itinerary and I have arrivals instead of chapters. So there are multiple arrivals and I wanted the structure of my work to reflect that. And the idea of arrival not being a final destination, that there are these series. It's not that I have arrived or someone has arrived. I don't think that ever happened. It's more of an ongoing process. And I also draw upon, Hannah Arendt's, notion of natality. And that's that an arrival, a moment of natality is like birth, right? And that when someone arrives in your world or your life or your classroom, that is a moment of arrival that is relational. If both of you actually arrive at that moment of connection and relationship. And in that moment, it's a moment of natality, of a birth in a way for both people. And to look at the opportunity there and how are you changed and how am I changed when we interact? Because both people are changed when we meet. And how I relate in that moment sometimes can be so critical. It might be just a moment in our past for some people, but sometimes a moment can exist always in someone's present. So that welcoming, that, and that, so, being conscious of that arrival, of the natality of that moment, and how both people are changed in relationship and how we respond leads right into that idea of radical acceptance. I get to choose my response and who I am in that arrival. And it's relational. And then the notion of radical acceptance, that I absolutely accept you and welcome you as you are in this moment, that you're being your best self, and to be able to see, when we're talking about disability, that child that arrives in my classroom, or that child that is born into my family, or that, you know, teenager that arrives home in that moment of frustration or whatever it is, like that they're bringing their whole self, their best self in that moment. And how do we see them, especially when we're talking about disability, as not broken, as not, I'll welcome you when you can do this, or once you can do that, then you'll be welcome. Because that, I think, sets up this whole thing. What if I can never do that thing? Would I not be welcomed? And there's a relationship to shame when there's not a welcoming, right? I would be welcomed if I just wasn't this about me, or just wasn't that. So I think radical acceptance is really key to inclusion, to saying that, and to understanding that that relationship is at the heart. Right. I mean, there's other things around universal design and looking at environment and looking at the way we structure learning and looking at honing in on like the big ideas. So, you know, the curriculum goal is like a huge target, you know, and we can all meet the, like, I could talk about that, but that's not what this is about. This is about how do we conceive of disability when we're layering that on in terms of radical acceptance?
Yeah, it's more of the way you, a mindset, or the way that you set your heart, right?
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to, it's not really a strategy. It's more of a...
No, it's not a program.
Right, yeah, exactly.
It's not like, on day two, you will do this worksheet, and then you'll be here. It's not a workbook. It is like, it's an attunement. It's the ocean, and you're the ocean and the craft, and the other person is the ocean and the craft. There's currents, there's undercurrents. We affect each other. We're the wind, we're the sail. We're both. And so it's how do we support one another? How do we work to understand perspectives and honor and really believe what children or students are telling us, like, that we honor and trust their experience, and again honor that lived experience and center it in our relationship.
Yeah. You share another example in the book, and this is an example from Harrison. And I don't remember, I'm not going to be able to remember the exact story, but he references, and you write in the book about him being out of ink, which I think is just such a brilliant way of saying, you know, how we all feel sometimes. And I wonder if that relates to this idea of spoons. I'm not a great, like, this is not how I would describe energy levels. But I know some people describe it that way. I was wondering if that's something that you could speak to.
Absolutely. So I think what you're talking about is Christine Misurandino's spoon theory.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a widely understood metaphor in disability communities, that resources can fluctuate, that they might be available one day and not another, and that they can be limited when you're disabled. And that there aren't just an endless supply of spoons. So you have to pick and choose. And sometimes you're just out of spoons and there's not more spoons. It's just like, that's it.
Right. Yeah.
And, I've shared that with my husband, Craig, and that whole idea of the metaphor and the ability to talk about our personal resources, whether it's like executive function or energy or focus or, just even patience, whatever it is. You know, it can be physical. It can be, all sorts of different kinds of resources, energy, and just being able to have the language to talk about, I don't have spoons for that, and to have the language to engage and understand each other, is great, and helpful and important to understand and talk about these perspectives. And I had often shared that, when I was, working with families and students. And, there's a quote actually from, Kimberly Faith, who was a part of the moderation and ongoing, organizing group with me in PACLA, which is Facebook and blog group, which is Parenting Autistic Children with Love and Acceptance. And, she has a quote. I hope I get it right. So, just because a disabled person is able to perform the way you think they should one time or a few times doesn't give you the right to hold that up over their head. It doesn't mean the act is sustainable. It doesn't dictate ability, capability, or potential. And if the disabled person is unable to replicate that again, it doesn't mean they chose not to do it or being defiant or otherwise trying to, quote, piss you off. And this is disability 101. That's the end of the quote. And I think that that uneven access to resources, that you can do something one day, but maybe not the next, is something that's seen as volitional or manipulative and framed that way. And so to give, teachers and families and parents and kids that students that or children that information is important. It's an important step in terms of being able to advocate for yourself, that self-understanding, the notion that, well, the connection between self-understanding and advocacy is huge. And then often it seems like when, because compliance can be so heavily enforced as a goal or a power, that if you don't do this, maybe none of the kids will, or I need to stay in control if you're a teacher or a parent. It can interfere with trust. And I'm going to come back to the out of ink, but I'm going to go a little bit somewhere first, just in terms of the understanding between advocacy and drawing lines and saying no and knowing what your limits are. Mm-hmm. And when you're learning a new skill, it can be messy. So, and when you're learning to advocate for yourself, it can be messy. Children might not sing, or people, anyone might not be children, might not sing their advocacy when they're learning the skill of advocating for themselves. It might not be in pretty tones or pretty words. On my blog, I have this blog written quite a long time ago, but with this idea of a tone hierarchy, and that often we see the tone as the most important thing as a hierarchy. And as educators and parents and other people working with disabled people, sometimes we put the tone as the most important and use that "you can't talk like that to me" tone as a way of disregarding all the rest of the message.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we can understand tone and interpret differently as a layered in understanding of the intensity this person's experiencing, not taking it on as something that's a challenge to us. And we could set aside tone in that moment of distress or moment of attempted advocacy and deal with it or address it at another time separately. But just read it as, wow, this is intense for that person, and actually still listen to what they're saying. The idea of when we're learning something new, and it might be clumsy and limit setting, and there's a blog, I have a post about that too, about how it can be messy at first, right? And that drawing your line before you're out of resources can be sloppy, messy, sticky, right? And that you might be advocating for yourself when you're already out of spoons, out of resources, and you're not regulated anymore. Instead of when you see it coming, understanding that, this is, and taking steps, you're like not taking a step until you're right. And as I bet as parents, we've both done that too. Like, you're home from work, the phone's ringing, you're trying to cook dinner, and your kid's asking your question all at the same time, and maybe it's not your best moment, right?
Mm-hmm.
So those points when we're at capacity. And I think supporting advocacy means that we're going to support the attempts to advocate even when it's not sung in pretty words, you know, even when the tone isn't nice, but we're going to trust the message because that builds relationship. So then if we look at I'm leading into the out of ink story. Mm-hmm. The idea that when spoons are gone, they're gone. Should I read a little bit about this story?
Yeah, please.
Okay. I've never shared the spoon theory with Harrison, and that is not an act of omission, but rather it's because he came up with his own metaphor before I had the opportunity. I remember one day a few years back asking him to do a thing, and he simply refused, nonplussed, matter-of-factly, explaining that he was out of ink. It was so clear. Nope, I'm out of ink. I cannot do that. I am done. Harrison was so solid and confident, and his assertion was just that. It was stated not as a complaint or with that apologetic wishing tone that might be used when someone feels shame that they're not able to do more. I know I felt shame when I lack resources, and at times I push until I cannot push anymore, whether it's pushing through chronic pain or handling sensory overload or ... I wonder how my stance conveys an underlying message to others and myself that I'm perhaps undeserving of limits, or that I'm seeking permission or the approval of others, essentially abdicating dominion over my body and my sense that of what will work for me. The line I draw might be blurry, drawn tentatively, and in a way that implies it's negotiable. And perhaps I should push it a bit further. Harrison's message conveyed no sense of shame. It was a clear, unequivocal delineation. There is no more ink. I'm out. This is not negotiable. Done. With all the aplomb of reporting a simple fact and a clarity that I long to emulate. No apology. No, I wish I could, or I'm sorry, or I hope I haven't let you or myself down. No offering up of evidence that reinforces that honoring his boundary was would somehow require proof that it's real. Nothing tentative in his assertion that creates a space for a second guessing or a place for the judgment of others to find a landing even. He demonstrates that he knows himself with a quiet, clear announcement. Nope, I'm out of ink. I cannot do that. I'm done. And so people could say like, well, what if I do that? What if they start doing that all the time? Right? What if they start? And I can tell you that because it's relational, I would say this would be true in a classroom too. Because Harrison knows I have his back and vice versa, he never pushes it. If he says he's out of ink, he's absolutely out of ink. And it's clear. And so I hardly ever hear it.
Mm-hmm.
Because he would only say it if he really needed it, because he trusts that he's going to be listened to.
Yeah.
That just seems so, like, I think I said earlier, trust when kids or students, people, tell us what they need. Trust them.
Right. Yeah, that's such an important point, because when you say that they're being manipulative, you know, it just shows how much you don't trust the learners in your classroom. And it also probably means how much they don't trust you.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
Maybe not you specifically, but just the environment or the space. Or,
sure.
Or maybe they're bringing previous experiences with them,
mm-hmm.
You know, and there can be some unlearning of both parts that need to happen. Like sometimes students have had experiences that don't have them feeling safe in particular environments or sometimes sadly in school or in other places. And so how do we build relationships that have them know that we're going to have their back?
Right.
And it's tricky, but I do really believe that the relationship is at the heart of it, you know?
When we return, the mystery question.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This is interesting. What's the strangest thing you've ever seen in the middle of the road?
Oh.
I'm trying to think. Gosh, what's the strangest thing?
Are you going to go first?
I've seen a lot of things in the middle of the road, but I don't know if any of them are that strange.
Well, I have one.
Okay. I'll go.
It's honestly the only thing that pops into my head.
Okay.
So I live in the Fraser Valley, close to Vancouver, British Columbia. And the community I am is sort of a farming community. And when my kids were little and I had to write report cards, I used to go to school really early in the morning because it was my way of stealing the time, right? If I did at the end of the day, I was too tired because there were family things. So I could just figure out how to steal time. I've always been thieving time from places that hopefully won't be noticed. So I'm on my way out this sort of country road to the school I taught at. Awesome, awesome little school. And there's a possum in the road. And it was lost. It honestly, often I see possums that have been hit by vehicles. And I have this moment where I realized my headlights were shining on it. And it was wandering you know, the family circus cartoon where the kids got to go get something from the garage and you see this huge path of all the other things that happen or whatever. I don't know if it's a garage, but it was like that multiplied with like exponents. Like this, it could not find its way off the road.
Oh, wow.
I was like, I just waited for a long time. I was kind of giggling and kind of going, wow, how long will it take? But it really was lost. And just, I don't know, maybe it was attracted by my headlights or something.
Uh-huh.
But it was just a very strange thing. And I have compassion for possums now. They do good things. They eat a lot of insects and that sort of thing. So they're good for the environment. Sometimes they're not very well loved. But seeing it lost in the middle of the road was pretty strange and kind of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. Weird.
Oh, well, thank you for sharing that. Gosh, I don't know if I can. All I kept thinking about was animals and not the live ones.
Oh, okay. We're on the same thing.
I know. There was a time when we were in Florida. It's in the St. Augustine area, so this would be like the opposite end of the panhandle, but just on the other side of Florida, mm-hmm. And we had gone to like a state park to camp, and there's this long stretch of road between the state park and like the main city. And so you'd have to drive that long part. And there were these enormous turtles that would go across the road, and they were not fast turtles.
But they were slow.
Exactly. And that's all I kept thinking about, how large these turtles were. And how you wouldn't want to hit one of these turtles, because it would seem like, well, not only would the turtle, you know, I'm sure perish, but also it would do some like a number on your vehicle. So, I just was fascinated with these turtles that would move so slow. And, but fortunately there were signs up everywhere warning you about the turtles. So it's not as if it would be a surprise. So I guess it wouldn't be necessarily be a strange thing, but we don't normally have turtles running around Georgia. So,
right. We don't really have turtles crossing around here.
No, no.
I mean, there's turtles around, but they're not the, big turtles.
Yeah. Little. The turtles we have are like tiny turtles. They're like in the river, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, anyways, well, great. See, that was fun. That was a good
question.
That was fun.
Yeah, it was unexpected.
It's kind of like a mystery question.
So we both had like creatures on the road. Mine was fast and lost. Yours was slow and very clear in its direction.
Exactly. Leah Kelly, thank you so much for being on the Think Inclusive podcast.
Well, Tim, thank you very much for having me. It was an honor, and I'd been very much looking forward to it. And it was great. Thanks.
That chime means it's free time. It's April, y'all, which is also Autism Acceptance Month. And to kick us off, I wanted to share a commencement speech with you. It's by Elizabeth Bonker, who is an autistic non-speaker who communicates by typing. I had the pleasure of meeting Elizabeth at the Council for Parent Attorneys and Advocates annual conference in March of this year. This speech is from 2022, when Elizabeth graduated as one of the valedictorians of Rollins College. And here is what I love about this speech. It's a call to take care of each other and to accept each other. And I think that is what this world needs more of.
Greetings to my fellow members of the elated class of 2022 and to the relieved parents, cheering siblings, and dear friends who supported us. Salutations to the caring faculty, administrators, and staff who fed our brains and nurtured our souls. I would also like to thank my fellow valedictorians, Emily Curran, Sophia Fraz, Charlie Mellon, and Jessica Linnemeyer, for giving me the honor of addressing you. Rollins College Class of 2022, today we celebrate our shared achievements. I know something about shared achievements, because I am affected by a form of autism that doesn't allow me to speak. My neuromotor issues also prevent me from tying my shoes or buttoning a shirt without assistance. I have typed this speech with one finger with a communication partner holding a keyboard. I am one of the lucky few non-speaking autistics who have been taught to type. That one critical intervention unlocked my mind from its silent cage, enabling me to communicate and to be educated, like my hero Helen Keller. My situation may be extreme, but I believe Rollins has shown all of us how sharing gives meaning to life. During my freshman year, I remember hearing a story about our favorite alumnus, Mr. Rogers. When he died, a handwritten note was found in his wallet. It said, "Life is for service." You have probably seen it on the plaque by Strong Hall. Life is for service. So simple, yet so profound. Classmates, you have shared your passion for service within our community. Our friends in the sororities and fraternities raise money for so many worthy causes. Our friends at Pinehurst weave blankets for the homeless. The examples are too numerous to list. Rollins has instilled in all of us that service to others gives meaning to our own lives and to those we serve. Viktor Frankl wrote about the power of sharing in his book, Man's Search for Meaning. While suffering in the Nazi concentration camp at Auschwitz, he noted how, despite the horror, there were prisoners who shared their last crust of bread. He writes, "Everything can be taken from a man, but one thing, the last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way." We all have been given so much, including the freedom to choose our own way. Personally, I have struggled my whole life with not being heard or accepted. A story on the front page of our local newspaper reported how the principal at my high school told a staff member, "The retard can't be valedictorian." Yet today, here I stand. Each day, I choose to celebrate small victories, and today, I am celebrating a big victory with all of you. The freedom to choose our own way is our fundamental human right, and it is a right worth defending, not just for us, but for every human being. I want to publicly thank Rollins College for taking a chance on me, for caring about every student, for being a place where kindness lives. Dear classmates, today we commence together. But from here, we will choose our own ways. For me, I have a dream. Yes, just like Martin Luther King Jr., I have a dream. Communication for all. There are 31 million non-speakers with autism in the world who are locked in a silent cage. My life will be dedicated to relieving them from suffering in silence and to giving them voices to choose their own way. What is your dream? How will you use your Rollins education to fulfill your mission? How will you rise up to meet the unprecedented challenges of our time? Whatever our life choices, each and every one of us can live a life of service to our families, to our communities, and to the world. And the world can't wait to see our light shine. So, my call to action today is simple. Tear off a small piece from your commencement program and write "Life is for service" on it. Yes. We gave you the pens to really do it. Let's start a new tradition. Take a photo and post it on social media. Then put it in your wallet or some other safe place, just as Mr. Rogers did. And when we see each other at our reunions, we can talk about how our commencement notes reminded us to serve others. We are all called to serve as an everyday act of humility, as a habit of mind. To see the worth in every person we serve. To strive to follow the example of those who chose to share their last crust of bread. For to whom much is given, much is expected. God gave you a voice. Use it. And know, the irony of a non-speaking autistic encouraging you to use your voice is not lost on me. Because if you can see the worth in me, then you can see the worth in everyone you meet. My fellow classmates, I leave you today with a quote from Alan Turing, who broke the Nazi encryption code to help win World War II. Sometimes, it is the people no one imagines anything of, who do the things no one can imagine. Be those people. Be the light. Fiat Lux. Thank you.
That's it for this episode of Think Inclusive. A big thank you to the Autism Society for being our sponsor for the month of April. Learn more at autismsociety.org. Think Inclusive is written, edited, designed, mixed, and mastered by me, Tim Viegas, and is a production of the Maryland Coalition for Inclusive Education. Are you ready to become an MCIE partner? Go to mcie.org to learn more about who we are and what we do. Original music by Miles Kredich. Additional music from Melody. That's MELOD.IE. Thanks for your time and attention. And remember, inclusion always works. Do you have any questions before we get started?
No, I listened to the other podcast, so I think I get it. We're just like having a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And if I like go, well, hang on, you can edit whatever out.
Yep. Yeah. If you, here it is.
Like, that was so awkward. Can I say that again? I should just go quiet.
Yeah, you can just say, hey, I'd like to say that again. And then I'll be like, okay.
Right. And you'll be able to like, and to not talk too fast will make things easier for editing, right?
Well, don't worry about me. Just talk however you want to talk. So, okay. Yeah. Yeah. No worries. All right. We good?
Yeah.
Okay.
From MCIE.